Welcome to ZMO Kitchen Talks, a podcast about historical and anthropological research in the Middle East, Africa, Eurasia, South and Southeast Asia, produced by Leibniz Zentrum Moderner Orient in Berlin. My name is Elisa Nobel-Dilati. I'm a Middle East anthropologist and knowledge transfer officer at ZMO. Over a cup of coffee or tea, I talk to renowned academics about their research questions, regions, and methodologies. We also take a look behind the scenes of academic practice at personal reflections, challenges, failures, and unexpected outcomes. Welcome to a new Kitchen Talk. Today's episode is about interfaith dialogue in Arab Christianity that has been researched by Dr. Arpan Roy, who is the guest of this episode. Hi, Arpan.
Hi, Elisa.
You are a Marie Curie postdoctoral fellow at Leibniz Zentrum Moderner Orient in Berlin and the author of Relative Strangers, Romani Kinship and Palestinian Difference that was just published in December 2024. And the co-editor of Nasij, Life Weavings of Palestine, that was published in March 2025. And Arpan holds a PhD in anthropology from Johns Hopkins University in the US. And the conversation with Arpan will be held by Dr. Sonia Hegazi, who is vice director and senior researcher at ZMO. Her research interests include modern Arab intellectual thought, Arab cultural history, state and society in the MENA region, as well as memory politics. Her recent publications include Hermeneutic Chicanery, a contribution to the debate on migration and memory in Germany, as well as Orientations, German scholarship on the Middle East since the 19th century, both from 2023 and Open Access. Sonia holds multiple honorary positions on academic advisory councils and was awarded a number of scholarships. Most recently, she was chosen as Thomas Mann Fellow 2025 in Los Angeles. I'm very happy to have you both here, and I'm going to hand over the microphone to you now.
Yeah, thank you very much, Elisa. And I'm very happy to have Arpan Roy today on ZMO's podcast.
Thank you very much, Sonia. It's a pleasure to be here, especially with you.
So you've been working about a Syriac monastery founded in the 1980s in 60 kilometers away from Damascus, the monastery of St. Moses of Abyssinia, founded by an Italian Jesuit, Paolo Dall'Oglio, who developed a praxis of Muslim-Christian interfaith dialogue in a very radical way, as we will learn from you today. And of course, in the first place, I'm interested, how did you come about this topic? What caught your first interest, especially since you worked about quite different topics so far? You published about biopolitics, urban imagination, or your most recent book on Romani life in Palestine. So was there a personal or biographical moment that sparked your interest?
Yes, there was one particular moment when I learned about Father Paolo. Of course, I remember early on in the Syrian war, there were these stories of priests getting kidnapped and so forth, but I didn't really pay attention to it so closely at the time. A few years ago, I was talking to a colleague at the time who was an archaeologist, Syrian archaeologist, but living in Italy. And he mentioned to me that he was already living in Italy when the war broke out. And he and some other Syrian activists were trying to put out a statement, a joint statement from various opposition groups. Kind of this was the liberal opposition, not the armed opposition. And Father Paolo was also part of these discussions, and anytime anybody would formulate a completely secular statement, Father Paolo would oppose, and he would say, no, there has to be a religious component of the opposition. There can be no atheist or secular, completely secular opposition in Syria because religion is a part of Syrian life. So he would actually block these statements from coming out in a healthy, discursive way. And I was thinking, who is this Italian priest taking this kind of radical approach to the Syrian opposition? So that's when I first became interested in Father Paolo. But when you say that I've published about different things and now this is yet another different topic, I would say they're all related in some way, in that I'm really interested in the topic of pluralism in the region, which we can call the Levant, or the Middle East, the Arab world, whatever you want to call it. And there is kind of a bridge, a trajectory from my research on Romani people to this, in that when I first started researching the Romani community in Jerusalem, I was in the beginning interested in the switch from Domari language to Arabic. So Domari is a Romani language that still exists in Palestine. And I was interested in if the switch from non-literacy to literacy, and with it, the increased exposure to Islam's discursive tradition, played a part in this complete switch from Domari language to Arabic, which happened in the last 30, 40 years. And for various reasons, I realized that this was not going to be a viable topic of research in my first few trips to Jerusalem trying to research this. So my research with Romanis took kind of a different turn, but that interest in religion stayed. Later, when I went to Jordan and started researching Romani communities there, I met these evangelical missionaries, evangelical Christian missionaries, working with Romani people. And there, I became interested in the topic of Christianity. But you see, the bridge to it was through Romani communities. And I became interested in Christianity in general, in theology in general, not specifically tied to the Romani community. And there you can see, again, this interest in pluralism in the region, this interest in multiplicity, in these diverse forms of life which are in the region. So that is the trajectory, that is the bridge. And as far as biopolitics goes, even though I'm researching Christianity in general, the first phase of this research has been on the topic of Syria and how Christianity expresses itself in the context of the Syrian war. So biopolitics is kind of a bridge between my research on Palestine and my research on Syria through Christianity. And the last thing I will say on this is that my own approach to research, you know, some people like to research things they already know a lot about. For me, it's the exact opposite. Syria is a place that I've been very interested in for my whole adult life that I've never had a chance to really get to know. And I think anthropology is a great way to get to know a place and an excuse to read a lot about a place. So I'm also using this opportunity to get to know Syria, to develop my own knowledge on Syria.
So who is Paolo Dell'Olio and how did he come to Syria?
Paolo Dell'Olio, or Paolo, Abuna Paolo, as we call him in Arabic, was an Italian Jesuit priest who was from very early on interested in the Arab world, in Arabic language, and in Islam. He first came to the region in 1977. This was at the beginning of the Lebanese Civil War. He was studying Arabic in Beirut. And in 1982, he was traveling around Syria. And we have to remember that 1982 was a particularly violent year in the region. This was the year of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, the bombings in Beirut. It was the year of the Sabra Shatila massacres. It was the year of Hafez al-Assad's bombing of and siege of Hama. It's a really, really brutal year. And he was traveling around Syria. And two particular events happened that year. One, he was traveling through a town called Busra in Syria, which has a kind of a special place in the Islamic tradition, because Islamic tradition holds that the Prophet Muhammad, when he would travel to Syria as a youth on these merchant caravans, passed through Busra and met a Christian monk who had a prophecy that Muhammad would become a great a messenger of God. So that's in the Islamic tradition. And when Father Paolo was traveling through Busra, he was invited by some local men that he met to pray in the mosque, the local mosque. And when he prayed in the mosque, he felt as if he had prayed in all the mosques of the world. Also in that same year, he came across the ruins of this 5th century monastery, Deir Marmousa al-Habashi, which had been out of commission for several centuries. So it was in ruins. And he went there to perform something called spiritual exercises, which is a set of monastic exercises associated with Saint Ignatius. And while he was performing these exercises over 10 days, he had a prophetic episode, and he had a visitation in which he was commanded to rebuild the monastery and establish his monastic community there. So that was the beginning of what later became known as the Al-Khalil community, Al-Khalil being a nickname of Abraham in Arabic. This was the beginning of the monastery, and even though Father Paolo came from a Jesuit background, he ordained his priesthood in the Syriac Rite, which is in full communion with the Holy See. So he had kind of a double belonging, not only to, as we will discuss, to Islam and Christianity, but also to the Jesuit order and to Syriac Christianity. The language of prayer at Marmousa was and is Arabic, which is possible in Syriac Christianity and not possible in the Jesuit order, for example. And Father Paolo, he had a special attraction to what is known as the Desert Fathers, which was a tradition of early Christian monasticism in the region in the first centuries of Christianity, which was quite widespread in Egypt, Palestine, Syria, and Anatolia, which was this culture of Christian monks living in the desert, very often in isolation. And this was something that was not known in Western Christianity. But this was the Christianity, or one of the forms of Christianity, that early Islam came into contact with. So according to Father Paolo, this culture of early Christian monasticism, which was never known in Western Christianity, is preserved in Eastern Christianity and also in Islam, particularly in the Sufi tradition. So to rediscover this lost Christian monasticism, one has to look to Islam, also to Eastern Christianity. And this was, in some ways, what he was trying to do in this monastery. So he began a process of rebuilding this monastery in the early 1980s, which was about a 20-year project. And as he established monastic life in the community, he borrowed very subtly from Islam. So very little things, for example, you know, in a superficial sense, like, you know, taking off your shoes before going into the monastery, which is something that is done in Islam. You know, you don't wear shoes into the mosque, to using Sufi instruments in the mass, or reciting subtle lines from the Quran, like Nur ala Nur, which is something from Surat al-Nur in the Quran, that would be incorporated into the prayers. So very subtle symbolic references to Islam. But more importantly, the monastery became a place for interfaith dialogue, both in an official sense, as they established official channels and official conferences of meetings between Muslim leaders and Christian leaders, but it also became a popular tourist destination in Syria, where people would just go. It was open to anybody at any time. So people who never really had an exposure to Christianity got to know Christianity through the monastery.
So where would that interest of Father Paolo come from to find these commonalities maybe between Christianity and Islam? Or why would he express some sort of double affiliation, I don't know, admiration or so? And then maybe, since you already mentioned this, I mean, would you consider him a mystic?
So Father Paolo left behind a body of writing, and he refers in this body of writing to St. Paul, who had the famous line, you know, "I will be a Jew to the Jews, and I will be free of the law to those who have no law." So there is a scriptural basis for this kind of plasticity, to adapt the parameters, the coordinates of the Christian faith to a local context. And that local context here was and is Islam. He calls this enculturation, which is also a term that comes up in Eastern Christian writing. Some of the contemporary Arab Christian intellectuals also use this term, so it's not unique to Father Paolo. But also in another sense, this plasticity, this enculturation, this hybridity has been a basic condition of religious life in the region for centuries. One has to remember that the Arab Levant was not majority Muslim until relatively recently. In Palestine, we know it was 13th century. Egypt was, you know, possibly around the same time. So there is this borrowing from each other that has extended into relatively recent history. And also, there is a movement in Arab Christianity, mostly in Lebanon and Palestine and Syria, but also to some extent in Egypt over the last several decades, called contextual theology, which Father Paolo was not expressly a part of, but somehow he was a part of this milieu, in which these Arab Christian intellectuals see the basic context for religious life in the region, including Christian religious life, to be Islam, in the same way that the context in Europe might be liberal modernity, right? So for example, when you have these religious debates about Christianity, Islam in Europe, it's understood that the basic condition of life is liberalism, secularism, modernity, which are all kind of related phenomena. And in that same way, that basic given, that condition of life in the Arab world is Islam, in the way that it's, you know, it's analogous here to liberal modernity. So the condition for that dialogue with Islam is already there. And I think Paolo was also contributing to this, perhaps not consciously.
But there is also this element of love and mystic unity, maybe, with God, and that he borrows elements from Sufism, or?
For sure. And the community has very good relations with Sufi groups.
What happened among the community when the revolution against the regime of Bashar al-Assad broke out? And how is their engagement in the revolution possibly connected to the end of what I actually prefer to call a governmental war on the people instead of a civil war? So how did they play a role, let's say, since 2012 in Syria? And could this be connected to how to deal with Hayat Tahrir Sham today?
So I will preface this answer to your question by saying that I'm not an authority on Syria. I've been researching in Palestine for 13 years, so I can speak on Palestine with more authority. But I can say some things. One is that we have to remember that Syria in 2011 was a very different place. That goes without saying. In general, it's common knowledge that the Christians of Syria, by and large, supported the Assad regime. And the regime in general had much more support at the time. We have to remember that in 2011, in October, there were pro-regime demonstrations of hundreds of thousands of people in Damascus and Aleppo, reported by the Western media. That is not the case anymore, right? There's been a total transformation of the political positioning of the Syrian people, and the transformation of the Christian community has to be seen within this larger transformation. I was talking to somebody recently, somebody who actually you know, Sonia, who was telling me, this is somebody who left Syria before the war, and he didn't go back to visit his family until just 2 years ago, just before the fall of the regime. And before going, his therapist told him, look, when you go, you have to remember that your mother and your sister are not the same people anymore. You have to talk to them as if you are talking to different people than the people you knew. So it's a different Syria. So all this is to say that the Christians who sided with the regime before the wars, or when the war started, are not the same Christians today. They're different people. Father Paolo was very unique in the Christian community for being an opposition activist. This was seen as quite radical in the Christian community at the time, and it got him exiled. He was asked to leave Syria in 2012. He snuck back in to Idlib a few months after being exiled, and he had some kind of relations with the Jabhat al-Nusra, which are the predecessors to HTS today. In some sense, it's the same group. And he was able to negotiate a prisoner release with them. And he also brought back the news of a prisoner they had killed, which was something. It was considered a success. Then he went back into exile. And then he decided at some point, when ISIS, Daesh, the Islamic State, was emerging as a group, and it wasn't really clear what this group was, he decided that he would try again to negotiate with them for some release of prisoners. And he snuck into Raqqa, and he presented himself to their headquarters, and he disappeared. Nobody knows with any certainty what happened. There is some reason to believe that he was killed, but there is no certainty. And when I met members of the community recently in January in Syria, some of them told me, well, finally the rest of the Christian community sees what Father Paolo saw at the time, that he was ahead of his time in this way. But I think I as a researcher, should take a wider view of this transformation. It's not just that the Christians woke up one day and decided that the regime was bad. There was a process of transformation that happened. And often when we talk about the Christian communities and what they went through, we lose sight of this transformation. For example, when HDS took over Aleppo in December, there was a video going around of a Christian priest, Hanel Jalouf, saying, you know, everything is good, everything is fine. Maybe you saw this video. It was a widely circulated video. The context that's missing is that Hanel Jalouf was a prisoner of al-Nusra also in Idlib during the war. He was held for some time. So there is a lot of context that's missing in the Christian reaction to HDS, to the Syrian war. And I would like to provide some of this context in this research that I'm doing.
But can we go back for a second to the interfaith activities of Father Paolo before the revolution and after, and how his, you talk about a concept called Badalia. What is behind it? How was it received in the Vatican? How did his own thinking develop over the years?
So Badalia is actually a 100-year-old concept. It was developed by Louis Massignon, the famous Orientalist scholar, the French Orientalist scholar, who had some very interesting episodes in his life that kind of led him to Badalia. One, Massignon, who came from a Catholic background in France, was a non-believer, and he was on a Turkish steamer on the Tigris in Iraq when he was suspected of being a spy. Him and the whole steamer was suspected of being a spy vessel, and they were besieged by Iraqis who were going to attack it. And Massignon thought that this is it for me, and he was going to stab himself when this is a very famous episode from his life, when he was visited by a divine stranger in his chamber in the vessel. That's when he accepted God and became a devout Catholic. And he's convinced that this intervention from God, this divine intervention, happened because of friendly Muslims who had been praying for his being saved, for his salvation. So this was a Badalia when the Muslims prayed for him and he was saved. And Badalia basically became a theology that Massignon later developed, where he prays for the salvation of a particular Muslim. And in that way, he saves that Muslim, grants him or her salvation. Now, Father Paolo took this basic framework as the condition of monastic life at Deir Marmoussa. The various community members at Marmoussa approach this concept differently. So I like to call Badaliya as an ethical field in which one can occupy various positions. But the basic framework, the basic field is of saving the other through prayer and fasting and so forth, in the way that Masignon was saved on the Tigris. Now, when Father Paolo started engaging with Islamist militants like al-Nusra and Daesh, when the war broke out, he thought of this as an extension of Badaliya, where he, when he went into Raqqa, he was, you know, in his mind, trying to change the heart, or trying to touch the hearts of the militants themselves. This was also a kind of Badaliya, a militant kind of Badaliya. And in that sense, kind of sacrifice his own life for the sake of the life of the militant. Badaliya, of course, coming from the Arabic word for badil, which is to substitute.
In a paper that you're going to publish soon, you make a divide in a way between European continental philosophy and this theology that Father Paolo developed. And you quote Heidegger saying that everything is relational, but except death. So death is actually the absolute singular. And you want to argue against it by pointing out that actually atonement and martyrdom are instances of dying for the other, and that death is not always one's own. And you write, I quote you here, that the likes of Heidegger and his more contemporary heirs like Nancy were not able to recognize the honor and sincerity in dying for a cause is reason enough to highlight a really existing barrier. So the barrier between metaphysical limits of continental philosophy. So has the Roman Church unlearned this aspect, or is death for the other non-existent in our today's secular discourse?
I mean, martyrdom was a major theme of early Christianity. Some of the earliest exactly. Christian theologians like Origen of Alexandria, martyrdom, it's all over the place, all over the writings. And arguably, the concept of martyrdom in Islam heavily borrows from this Christian concept of martyrdom. The word shaheed in the Quran is used not to describe the martyr, it's used to describe the witness. And only later, it also comes to mean martyr. And this transformation also happens in Christianity. This movement of martyr from somebody who, like a legal witness, or witnesses God, to somebody who dies for God. This movement also happened in Christianity. So, in Islam, which again it emerged in this largely Byzantine world, I think it also picked up on this movement from witness to death for a cause. And I think this is something that has been not unlearned by the Roman Church. It's been unlearned by liberal secularity, where, you know, in this kind of rationalist, scientific mode of engaging with the world, we don't think that a cause is worth dying for. And this is simply not the case in the Muslim world, where the word shaheed is completely normalized in conflicts from Palestine to Kashmir to the Kurdish struggle. It's a really normalized and accepted word and ontology, really, where you can actually die for a cause that is not your own personal salvation. So I think Badaliya also, the Badaliya in Father Paolo's iteration, not Masignon's, also is a part of this ontology of the region.
So we learned that Father Paolo actually extended his idea of interfaith dialogue to these militant Islamist groupings in Syria like Daesh and the so-called Islamic State. And you say that he did so on the basis that they are also people of faith, Rijaluddin. And I would say that many Muslims, since especially the attacks of Al-Qaeda in 2001 on the World Trade Center in New York and in on the Pentagon in Washington, argue that members of the so-called Islamic State or Al-Qaeda are not people of the Islamic faith. And I wonder if that contradiction has been taken up by Father Paolo in one way or the other, whether he debated that, whether he was confronted with that aspect.
He was really interested also in Al-Qaeda from very early on. Now, the argument could be made that when he tried to meet Daesh, he wanted to meet Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. That this was the early year, the early emergence of Daesh, of the Islamic State, and we didn't really know at the time what they would become. But he also wanted to meet Osama bin Laden from the 1990s onward, which he never did. But he had that desire
In order to do what?
To engage with the militant on theological grounds. Because theology here, for him, was a mode of engagement. You know, he felt that he could, in the same way that in interfaith dialogue, you engage theologically with someone from a different faith, you have a basis for dialogue, which is theology. Now, it is true, as you say, that all the major Muslim organizations in the world that I know of disavowed Daesh. They said this is not Islam. They all made statements, this is not Islam. And I think that's really important in the European-American context with all this xenophobia and Islamophobia and so forth. That's fine. But, you know, if this question, you know, is Daesh Islamic, I think is actually a very complex question. And I would like to answer this by evoking Talal Asad, who, you know, the anthropologist, who sees Islam as a discursive tradition, which is a famous position of his, starting with the Hadith and the Quran and all that, you know, the jurisprudence and all this fiqh, you know, that comes after. And this is often in the Islamic studies literature, this is positioned against the position of many who say, well, actually, all these heterogeneous, often esoteric Islamic sects, Sufi sects, some that advocate wine drinking and, you know, things that are not accepted in mainstream Islam, well, this is also Islam. And what Talal Asad says is that, okay, but when someone says that this is not Islam, that is a legitimate theological position. So the negative definition of Islam, according to Asad, is legitimate. I would like to flip this around by saying, okay, you say this is not Islam, but when somebody says we are behaving on behalf of Islam, how can you accept a negative definition but not the positive definition? And it's very, you know, when we want to distance ourselves from horror, you know, we make these negative disqualifications. We say that Hindutva is not Hinduism. We say Zionism is not Judaism, right? We say these things, and maybe that's true. But would we say, for example, Maoism is not Marxism? Would, you know, Maoism would not be recognizable to Marx. But can we actually say that Maoism is not Marxism? Or, for example, liberal economics. For example, an IMF goes into a town in Latin America and Africa and decimates it with horrible policies. Can we say this is not liberalism? It would. I'm sure that Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, Adam Smith, would be totally against Coca-Cola going into a town and taking the water supply from that village in Bolivia, for example. But can we actually say that this is not liberalism?
Okay, I see your argument for Islamism. Mm-hmm.
But I would just like to add one more thing. So when we say that this is not something, when we make this really assertive statement, I think we are reducing the intellectual complexity of the situation. And when we do away with complexity and nuances, we do away with theoretical possibility, political possibility, and this is very dangerous. So I would like to insist on working with the complexity of things and not just saying, well, this is not this.
At the very beginning, I mean, how big was the component of missionary work for Father Paolo when he built the monastery and then founded the community.
In general, in Catholicism, in contrast to Protestant churches, there has been a move away from the concept of the mission as knocking on someone's door and coming with Bibles and, you know, this kind of classic idea of missionary work. Especially under the papacy of Pope Francis, there has been a distinction between evangelization, which is kind of a mode of living, living by example, of living a good evangelical life, evangelical coming from the word for from the Injil, from evangelists. So living a biblical life, a Christ-like life, which will naturally attract people to the way of Jesus, as opposed to proselytization, which is actively trying to convert people to Christianity. And I would say that Father Paolo's mission in life, to not use it as a pun, has been in line with this general switch to this evangelical mode of life, this evangelical form of life, rather than actively trying to convert people to Christianity. So in this sense, he's been very consistent with this larger trend in Catholicism.
And what can you tell us about the community today?
Before the war broke out, the Marmoussa community expanded to a second monastery in Iraq, in Soleimania, in Iraqi Kurdistan, which was an invitation from the Archbishop of Kirkuk, who was Chaldean, the Chaldean Archbishop. There is something very interesting there. And also a third monastery was opened in the Syrian village of Al-Qaryatayn, not so far from Marmoussa. So the community was growing before the war broke out. But the war has had devastating consequences. One, I mean, the disappearance and possible martyrdom of Father Paolo being the major rupture. But also, Syria was closed for 14 years. It was not open to travelers and visitors. So the work of the monastery was greatly affected by this. But they're still there. The monastic community is still, they're still there. They're praying. They're living their monastic life.
And maybe for my final question, are there any ethnographic moments or interviews that particularly touched you or surprised you?
So I finally went to Marmoussa in January. I had been before this working with members of the community, not in Syria, in Bethlehem, in Italy, in Iraq. But after the fall of the Assad regime, I was able to go without a visa to Syria. And I stayed at Marmoussa for 6 nights, and I would attend the Mass every evening. So they have Mass twice a day, and before the evening Mass, they have an hour of meditation and then the Mass. And my final night attending Mass, the current head of the monastery, Father Jihad, blessed my research. He blessed me. He prayed and blessed my research, and it was quite a touching moment for me. And in fact, I had already been trying to work on this article while trying to be academically efficient. I was writing while doing the research, and I was stuck theoretically. And in fact, the next day, all kinds of things opened up in the writing. So I think I reaped the barake from the blessings right away.
Yeah, thank you very much for bringing this to our attention. And I guess for everyone who wants to learn more about it, they should read your article. I don't know if you already know where it will be published. Not yet. But I thank you very much for looking into this fascinating topic. And thank you for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you, Sonia.